Hey guys, welcome to episode number 36 of the Future Thinkers podcast. Today our guest is Daniel Schmachtenberger. Daniel is an evolutionary philosopher, strategist, and social engineer. His work focuses on complex systems, the evolution of humanity, and global resource allocation. His goal is to find the shortest path to a fundamentally redesigned world system that supports in an ongoing way the highest quality of life for everybody on the planet. He specifically focuses on developing economic and governmental systems that, by design, incentivize life-enhancing behavior.
Daniel's recent project is Neurohacker Collective, which is a smart drug brand with a vision of holistic human optimization. In this episode, Daniel talks about many deep and fascinating ideas to do with building a better future for all of humanity. He specifically talks about the different systems we will need to transition into this new world and to mitigate existential risks. This is a really great episode. I think it's one of our favorites. If you want all the show notes, books, and mentions from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/36. Before we get into it, as always, I want to thank our recent patrons and donors, Diana, Pascal, Rich, and Nigel. Thank you guys for making the show happen. You're awesome. All right, here's the show.
Welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. This episode is brought to you by Eternity, the Oracle Machine. Eternity is a new blockchain platform for smart contracts with a token crowd sale launching in March 2017. Go to futurethinkers.org/eternity and subscribe to their mailing list to get notified when it goes live.
To get notified of new podcasts and videos, go to futurethinkers.org and subscribe to our mailing list. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, give us a like or a review, share it with your friends, and consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/futurethinkers. If you're looking to get serious about meditation, check out the meditation app that we've created with Vinay Gupta called The Cutting Machinery. Go to cuttingmachinery.org/app. Daniel, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. So we're going to have a lot of things to talk about today, but why don't we start by talking about an optimistic future of humanity and what we need to do to transition into that future? There are a lot of visions and theories out there about the ultimate macro system that we need to adopt, not only to survive this century, but to thrive. What is your vision of that?
First, I wouldn't talk in terms of an ultimate system. Talk in terms of ongoing evolution. And so rather than kind of a utopian as one has previously thought of a perfected system, we're going to think of a protopian process, right? A process of emergence into more elegantly ordered complexity that has more and more emergent properties and more of the things we're interested in and gets over some of the underlying causes of things that we want to get past. I would say that rather than just iterative evolution, we are on the brink of a phase shift. And phase shift defined by core axioms and core foundations of most of our macro global systems, from our worldview to our economics to our governance to our infrastructure, going through foundational shifts. So this looks like a step function in evolution, where we have had capitalism that has gone through kind of iterative developmental processes, and we've had representative democracy that's gone through iterative developmental processes and, you know, scientific methodology and worldview and et cetera. Now we are on the brink of something that requires larger, more fundamental, axiomatic, and structural shift. And so we can talk about what the criteria for the other side of that have to look like for it to be a non-self-terminating system and for it to be a anti-fragile system. And those are two of the important criteria of any kind of world that is interesting for anyone, right? It is definitely non-self-terminating and then not anti-fragile. Then there's more things we'll talk about on top of that. So do you want to talk about what those criteria must be?
Well, sure. But first, let's define the problem. So what's wrong with our current system and why do we need to transition out of it?
So when we say our current system, we are sweeping a lot of things together and it's worth kind of pulling those apart a bit. We might be talking about macroeconomics, which obviously the macroeconomics of China and the macroeconomics of Russia, the macroeconomics of the United States, of NATO are different systems. But there are kind of beyond national, global economic systems that we can look at. We can look at governance systems, again, national and then transnational governance, and then beyond anything that's codified, how human decision-making works, right? We can think of governance in the highest sense of how do we do collective decision making at various scales, from a business to a family to a nation to groups of nations to a species as a whole, navigating things that face the whole species. Economics, we can think about how do we do resource allocation and how do we do human incentive systems. With infrastructure, we can talk about how do we meet our physical needs in relationship with the physical planet, right? Education, medicine. So we have a lot of different systems that co-evolved and they are interconnected and inter-influencing. And then you can think of a, you know, kind of evolving paradigm that involves all of those things, but we're going to need to talk about at least the core ones in distinction from each other. So what is the problem we're trying to fix? Well, one thing is those current systems, the interface of those current systems with each other and the net effects are unsustainable, and unsustainable means self-terminating, means that these systems run to their own end and then fall off some kind of cliff, right? And so when we look at growth curves of different kinds of organisms, anytime we see a growth curve that has an exponential up, that is not forever. And sometimes the exponential up goes logistic, and that's very nice. Sometimes it drops off pretty hard before it logistics. Sometimes it goes through a lot of instability. Sometimes it just exponentials up and then drops off a cliff, right? So we were under 500 million population for all of human history, as far as we know, 200 plus thousand years until the Industrial Revolution. And then in just over 200 years, we went up to over 7 billion people and growing. And that is a profound exponential population curve. Not only have we went through this profound exponential population curve in relationship to our ability to extract resources from the planet that are not replenishing themselves, which is what the Industrial Revolution was, right? Mining, farming, fishing, logging, et cetera. The ability to take some kind of resource reserves that took hundreds of millions or billions of years to develop and to be able to extract them at a radically fast pace. And obviously much faster than they can renew. And then the population is growing on that savings account until you hit the end of the savings account. And then there's real problems. Not only have we been growing in population, but we've been growing in resource consumption per capita. So this is a multiplicative issue that we are getting near the end of the viability of that particular part of, right? When we think about running an economy that requires year-over-year growth, requires it, because you're fractionalizing the monetary supply, even deeper than that, just interest, where the monetary supply has to fundamentally expand, right? Then to not debase the currency, you have to increase the total amount of goods and services. Services sit on top of product economies, which relate to a linear materials economy, product materials economy, which the linear materials economy means extracting resources from the planet unrenewably, which means devastation of ecosystems and things like that. And then turning them into trash in ways that usually consume a good bit of energy from dirty sources, create a lot of pollution and externalize harm to people and environments along the way, you know, and then end with waste. So that kind of exponential growth economy and attached to a linear materials economy just doesn't work ongoingly on a finite planet, right? It only would work ongoingly on an infinite playing field, which we're not on. And so that is a fundamentally self-terminating system. It makes plenty of sense that when there was just so much low-hanging fruit in terms of coal and oil and fish and trees and et cetera, that we would do this exponential boom kind of thing. It's just that's not viable anymore. It also happens to be that the technologies that would allow us to be really viable in a post-growth economic system, it's not about net more consumption, but about using the same things in a closed-loop materials economy in ever more interesting ways. So a materials economy that is closed loop, post-growth, and upcycling, continuously upcycling. The technology it takes to do that is technology we are just now getting. Happens to be that that's at the same time that we are just now getting to the point of self-termination of the old system, right? So we both have to shift and can at the same time. The technologies it takes to build this kind of sustainable, regenerative, thriving, new set of world systems is technology that we developed via capitalism and linear materials economy and the military-industrial complex and all those things. So they served an evolutionary relevance in terms of where we're going, and they have just completed a particular evolutionary relevant life cycle. Now we're going through a discrete phase shift into a new life cycle, very much like a fetal time period, right? An embryonic time period is unsustainable. The caterpillar can't just keep devastating its ecosystem without pollinating forever, but that's not how it works. And a baby couldn't stay in the belly after 40 weeks and act parasitically, but that's not how it works. It is going through a period where its system is fundamentally not capable of the kinds of autonomy that it will later be capable of. So it's a finite evolutionary period of unsustainable development to then go through a discrete phase shift to then be in a fundamentally new period. And so I think it's a very fair analogy to look at humanity as having been in a kind of embryonic period. Bucky Fuller used to like to speak to it like that, like a, you know, chicken embryo having finished eating the egg white unrenewable resources, emerge from a world it didn't know it was in, right? Emerge from the shell into a world where that it now has a beak to eat that it didn't have before when it was eating the egg whites, come from plants that its poop fertilizes, and it's part of this larger kind of regenerative process that evolved. So when we talk about what the problem is, our materials economy is unsustainable. Our macroeconomic structures themselves, our ideas of ownership and valuation and et cetera, are all fundamentally unsustainable. They're coming up on the cliffs of unsustainability. Our exponentially increasing tech curves are creating more and more existential threats, et cetera, right? So this is all what we would call self-terminating. And even before we get into existential and catastrophic risks, it's also already causing suffering at just such massive scales, whether we're talking about, you know, war and drone strikes on civilians, or whether we're talking about factory farms that are these just rolling apocalypses, or whether we're talking about fishing the oceans down to nearly nothing, or what. We can forecast future catastrophic scenarios, but we're in them, right? We're in these rolling catastrophes moving towards complete unviability. And so the future systems we're interested in have to prevent total existential risk and total catastrophic risk. They have to solve the foundational causes of the current unnecessary human-induced suffering, and then create world systems that make possible and probable and induce higher quality of life across all the very meaningful quality of life metrics for all life, and optimize evolutionary rate.
It seems like most people are saying capitalism is what's gotten us here, and you're just taking a couple extra steps to see where it results. You know, A plus B equals C. Or when we've proposed basic income in the past, that's usually their answer. Well, capitalism has got us this far. Why would it not take us further?
You know, you think about that embryo, that baby growing in the mother's belly. And if you didn't know that it was a baby that was going to birth at a certain point, it would be easy to mistake it as a very serious parasite.
Yes.
Because it is taking a lot of nutritional load from her body, right? It is modifying her physiology profoundly. And if you imagine a mom in the 8th or 9th month, if you didn't know that there was a discrete phase shift about to happen, you'd be pretty sure she was very near dying in a pretty terrible way. The difference between a parasite and a baby is that the baby goes through that for a finite period and then phase shifts into a different phase, right? Interestingly, when we look at parasitology, virology, bacteriology, there are many parasites that when they initially start feeding on an animal, human, whatever, and they haven't before, they kill them fairly quickly. The ones that were aggressive enough to kill the hosts quickly don't propagate, right? Because they killed their host, they don't live very long, they don't get to travel on to many other hosts. The milder versions that don't actually kill their hosts get to both live longer and propagate more. And so there are a number of pathogens that get less toxic over an evolutionary time frame because they have to be. We don't get the chance of killing lots of planets to figure out, you know, we could do it that way, and that only the planets where the people were less problematic in this way end up making it through. But we want to do a more conscious version than that, right? And so rather than the slow evolution of a parasite to be less pathologic, we need to do the actually going through a birth into a new phase model. And we can. What's so fascinating is that if we define a civilization where we have a sustainable population that does not require imposition from the outside, some kind of eugenics program or Chinese birth limiting program, whatever. It is a emergent self-organizing phenomena. And we've already seen plenty of places in the world where when education gets high enough, economics and female empowerment and et cetera, that population stabilizes, can even decrease to find the right levels of where it's at. We've seen that in Japan. We've seen it in some of the Scandinavian countries. And so to have a steady state population that is within the sustainable carrying capacity of the planet, connected to a post-growth materials economy, where the materials that we are using are being designed in a cradle-to-cradle way, where their recyclability after this particular use is built right in. There's no such thing as waste. There's just moving the old stuff back into new stuff. The new stuff is being made from old stuff, so it doesn't require virgin resource acquisition. The only new thing coming into the system, and doesn't mean we won't ever take a new thing into the system as far as atoms go. We could. We find an asteroid with some interesting platinum. We could do that. But we have a system that doesn't require trash or extraction, right? That's what post-growth means, is post-necessity for growth, so that it actually can be sustainable, viable. And then we just keep increasing the efficiency of how we utilize those resources and attenuating the forms that they're in. The only resource that we keep bringing into the system continuously is energy, because that's what we keep having ongoing access to. So we have new photons coming in all the time. We don't have new atoms coming in all the time, right? These new photons coming in all the time allows us to keep recycling the atoms where we're upcycling them rather than downcycling them, because this is not a closed system, right? We get to externalize entropy out of the system, bring, you know, enough energy to keep driving more centropy in the system. So when we ask what are the necessary and sufficient criteria of a sustainable, non-self-terminating, thriving, anti-fragile world that does obsolete the catastrophic and existential risks, the current cause of suffering, create higher qualities of life. We could actually do this construction in detail sometime, but I'll just kind of state the things. As far as infrastructure goes, our physical relationship with the physical world, it does require these three criteria: closed loop, post-growth, and upcycling, right? Negative entropy, but it's not actually negative entropy in a thermodynamic sense, because we're bringing energy into the system. As far as social systems go, economics, governance, law, language, right? The social agreement fields by which we navigate collective agreement, collective decision-making, collective resource allocation, all the things beyond just individual action. We can think of governance as how we make decisions that involve co-decision-making, collaborative decision-making. Most all of the decisions we're going to make are going to involve allocating resources of some kind, some way. So we think of economics as how we allocate resources. And the other major thing that economics has done is human incentive. So when there's a bunch of shitty jobs that nobody, if they didn't have to, would want to spend all of their life doing, maybe I'll pave a road a little bit now and again, but I don't want to spend 40 hours a week my entire life until retirement doing that. As long as we have shitty jobs, especially in the labor economy, that the society needs done for the quality of life that is related to infrastructure, then we need to get the people to do the jobs. Adam Smith talked about this, Marx did, everybody did, right? It's the core of economic theory. So if you do some kind of communism where everyone's needs are met by the system, then how do you get the people to do the shitty jobs? Well, then the state has to force them, and we call that imperialism, and it's why we don't like communism, right? Or everyone has to do an equal amount, but that's still who is going to enforce that? State has to enforce them. So capitalism says, no, no, we'll let the free market enforce them, right? Which is, if they don't do the shitty jobs, they just go homeless. That's really not freedom still. It just moved the forcing function from the state to the market, right? Well, as we're moving into technological automation, this foundational axiom of all economic theories, which is how do we deal with the labor economy, right? This is an axiomatic topic, is being obsoleted. We're obsoleting that. All of the conversations that Marx and Smith and friends had. And so that both solves problems and it brings new ones. So when we have technological automation that is capable of automating the shitty jobs. And it's important to get, when I say that, that doesn't mean that the machines are going to take your jobs and you can't garden if you want to. Of course you can fucking garden or wash your toilet if you want to. You just don't have to wash your toilet all the time, because we can make bathrooms that clean themselves better, right? And then if you just want to do that, you're welcome to. Human freedom can absolutely do that. If you want to garden, you're welcome to do that. But can we create vertical agriculture systems that automate many aspects of that while providing high quality, nutritious food with lower impact on the environment? Yes, we can, right? And that opens up more human freedom, not does the other. So as long as we have a situation where the jobs need the people, then we have to make it where the people also need the jobs, i.e. capitalism, right? Which is why that system has, you know, succeeded in a Darwinian sense in the way that it has. It's important to get that Darwinian selection does not select for the true, the good, and the beautiful, right? It selects for what is adaptive, which means what is dominant within scarcity dynamics now, even if that's going to, you know, be going extinct in the very near future because it's not forecasting, it's not adequately forecasting, right? As soon as you can make it to where the jobs don't need the people via automation, you can also make it where the people don't need the jobs, which is what the Commonwealth economics is moving towards. And a first step in the direction is the basic income. Basic income is not enough, but it is a step. And the key for it not to be a welfare system, when we think about the problems of the welfare system and how you have people who don't have the Darwinian motive to create that capitalism gave them, so they just sit on the couch and smoke crack all day. Those are people that have already been broken. This is a very important point. When you look at little children, they're asking questions all day long. Why is fire hot? Why is the sky blue? Where do we go after we die? Where do you, they're fascinated, asking deep philosophic and physics and, you know, et cetera questions. And they want to help do stuff and they want to build stuff. And then we don't answer those questions because why the fuck is fire hot? That's actually a very deep physics question. And then it's moving from physics to consciousness studies at the mind-brain interface of subjective experience of hotness with photons on the skin and nerve pathways. And so we say, I don't know, spell cat. And we don't facilitate their interests while forcing them to be interested in completely uninteresting shit and thereby breaking their interest in life. So then they just want to veg the fuck out, right? And so now we have broken humans where if they can just veg out, they will. But this is not human nature. This is broken humans in a system that systematically breaks humans. And so it's very important to get that in this kind of economic system that we're proposing, there's a fundamentally different education system that's possible because we don't have to prepare kids for the workforce. And since we don't have to prepare them for the workforce, the whole goal of education becomes identifying the unique aptitude and interest and fascination and inclination of each child and facilitating the shit out of it. And realizing that they don't have to actually be able to do everything because we've automated a lot of things and then we've shared a lot of things, right? But what they can uniquely do and what they can light up the most in uniquely doing and then have the benefit of that be fully available to everyone in a Commonwealth economics that makes radically more abundance possible than for everyone, than is actually possible for anyone in this system. I'll come back to explaining how that's possible. Then that's the goal of education, right? Facilitating the emergence of radical uniqueness.
When I think about what is required in this post-birth sort of society, I'm going to call it, I think people are optimizers. So it's more like picking the route or direction that they want to go to and then make that part of the system more efficient over time. Like I myself do that with every aspect of our lives, with our website, with, you know, I'm like an efficiency optimizer. No doubt people, when they find what their calling is, what they want to be doing, they're going to spend a lot of time doing exactly that in the grander scale. The way you say the incentives are all out of whack, yeah, it demotivates them to learn, which in turn demotivates them to optimize anything, which is exactly what this new system needs.
And since you identify as an optimizer, then you think of it through the lens of that they'll all be optimizing. That's a good lens. Someone else would say that they will all be creating.
Yeah, that's me.
While they map to each other, they're both different experiences phenomenologically, and they actually are different parts of the creative life cycle and et cetera, right? Different modes. You also have some people who identify things that they're particularly passionate about, where all of the topics they're passionate about kind of braid together into a very clear through line. And there will be other people for whom that's much less clear, that are more focused on interpersonal connection and depth of subjective experience and the creative process itself, independent of any particular result that's being produced. And one of the beautiful things is that's not possible in a macroeconomic system where you say, how do you turn that into the dollars you need to live? In a macroeconomic system where that's not the question, there is an important difference between appreciable wealth and exchangeable wealth. When we think about a rainbow, it's not extractable and exchangeable wealth for anyone seeing a rainbow. When you think about hearing a song, when you think about somebody complimenting you, seeing a smile, like none of these are things you can put on a balance sheet in any metricable way. But when you think about what makes life most rich, it's largely these things that fit into appreciable but non-quantifiable wealth. And so one of the beautiful things that happens when the primary balance sheet that we're paying attention to is the balance sheet of the commons, the natural world commons and the built world commons that everyone has access to without possessing, is that we have a system that gets to start optimizing for appreciable wealth generation, because we're not only focused on exchangeable wealth accounting systems.
I think we're already seeing that a little bit with the internet, where people are producing, you know, they're producing music, they're making memes, they're writing vlogs, but they're not really, most of the time, they're not expecting to make money from it. They're just doing it because it's exciting for them, or they get some sort of satisfaction out of just producing it and putting it out there. And it's accessible to the world of the internet.
Now, while those people still have to work their day job to support themselves, and then they're going to come to their music, and their day job might happen to be something that they experience as relatively soul-crushing in terms of the possibilities they know how to access, then they come to that little bit of music. You think about, well, what would happen if we just supported them to be in the position to do music as deeply as they could, wanted to, right? And what if they didn't have to try and gear it towards what was sellable, so that they could then switch from the soul-crushing to the money-making music, but what was really authentically what they felt was their greatest offering, you know, their most unique offering. We get a very different kind of creativity happening. One of the issues right now we see in this kind of post-fact world, where what is fake news and what is not fake news, and what one of the issues of the inability to make sense of almost anything that we're facing is how much of any news that you find or any idea has some financial interest associated with it. How much education is an advertorial, you know, in some way? How much of science itself is actually just the R&D arm of capitalism funded by something that has a vested interest attached? And so this is a very tricky process, right? Where what we can actually believe in, and then how much of music is geared towards what is going to have the right kinds of frames for memeability so that it can get poppy enough to sell Pepsi or whatever, rather than what is actually what someone most authentically wants to create, that other people would most authentically want to experience. You think about what it means to create systems that remove all of those other agendas, so that there are no vested interest agendas. So now, you know, we talked about that the criteria for infrastructure, what that had to be. Here's the criteria for social systems. We said governance is decision-making, economics is decision-making and incentive, but we just started to kind of hint at that the incentive moves from primarily extrinsic incentive to intrinsic incentive. And you have a system that's all about facilitating intrinsic generative incentive, right? Which de-necessitates most of extrinsic incentive, which becomes key. Then economics is largely about resource allocation systems, optimization of resource allocation towards all the various goals that matter. So most decision making in, you know, governance is around resource decisions. Law is how do we make sure that those decisions actually get followed through. So we can actually think of economics as the heart of social systems, right? So the key criteria for the future of macroeconomics is that all the externalities get internalized, meaning everything that we affect by a decision is factored in the decision making process and the process by which resources get conferred to things. So another way to say this is that the agency, the incentive of every agent, whether it's a person or a group of people called a company or a country, even though I believe both of those two things will become obsolete, just think any person or group of people, any agent, the incentive of that agent has to be perfectly aligned with the well-being of every other agent and of the commons as a whole. The degree to which the individual agents are incentivized to do something that is externalizing harm to other agents of the commons is the degree to which Those problematic externalities will continue to happen ubiquitously in a decentralized fashion at scale because they are incentivized in a decentralized fashion at scale. That's the key of the future of macroeconomics, is the alignment of agency and well-being from individuals and commons. And that correlates with closing the loop, right? We talked about a linear materials economy moving to a closed loop one, right? In the same way here, we're closing the loop between agency of individuals, well-being of others, right? All the externalities being internalized is moving from an open loop system where I could affect things but not internalize those effects in the cost equation to now all internalized in the cost equation. And then that corresponds to a worldview where my sense of self and my sense of the rest of the universe are not fundamentally separate concepts. That I wouldn't exist without oxygen at all. I wouldn't exist without the plants that make the oxygen. I wouldn't exist without the bugs and the fungus that make the plants work to make the oxygen. I am not an individual. I do happen to have a self-organizing membrane that has some individuality to it, but I am an emergent property of everything else. So when you close the loop between sense of self and sense of other, then what's in my best interest, what's in the best interest of others, also there's a loop closure between advantage self at the expense of others or sacrifice self for the well-being of others, both of which are nonsense in a radically interconnected system. So what we're looking at is how we close all the causal loops so that everything that influences decision-making is being informed by everything being influenced.
That sounds like quite a spiritual proposition also. It relates to some of the ideas that I've heard, for example, Ken Wilber talking about.
Sure.
Where this kind of evolution of the system and evolution of the self converge.
I believe I actually have the quadrants on the whiteboard behind me from a conversation earlier. Ultimately, so if we'll just use the quadrants from integral philosophy for a moment, when we're talking about the evolution of infrastructure, we're talking about the lower right-hand quadrant, right? The plural, not just single, right? External. So all of physical infrastructure is the physicality of the collective. When we're talking about social structures, we're talking about the lower left, which is the interior, right? The agreement fields that we agree to use this word to symbolize this experience or this meaning. We agree to denote this value to these things. We agree to make decisions in this way is the lower left. The upper left is our individual value system, our worldview, our internal singular process, right? Which is affected by education and culture and media and et cetera. The upper right would be human physiology. And we usually think of physiology as nature and the other three collectively as nurture. The other three can change and collectively make up culture, which is nurture, which is then conditioning the expression of genetic predisposition. Because we are, of course, changing radically one generation to the next mimetically much faster than we're changing genetically. But that's not an adequate way to think of it, because physiology can actually affect human experience and human predisposition radically independent of just genome change through natural selection. Everyone who's had their hormones off knows that you can be incapable of accessing certain emotions or incapable of being out of other emotions, right? Everyone who's had their neurochemistry deeply off or just been very sick or tired has known certain cognitive abilities can shut down or other ones be, you know, over predisposed. So when you realize that empathy runs on certain neural networks and that can be downregulated or upregulated, right? Complex thinking runs in certain kinds of neural processes. And if those are damaged or not developed, it can lead to fundamentalism and only being able to see something one way from a hardware point of view, not just a mimetic point of view, right? And you can also upregulate the kind of connectomic complexity that leads to more net information processing and perspective taking. So what has to happen in the upper right, so we can think about the upper quadrants as being about the individual. The upper right is kind of the hardware of the individual. The upper left is the software of the individual, right? So you can think about human physiology and then human mimetics, worldview, values, definition of success, psyche, right, is the software. But of course, it's a place where the software and hardware are not as distinct as they are in computer systems. Every software change is actually plastically changing the hardware, and vice versa, the hardware is predisposing software so that you can see the analogy, but also its limit. Then you can think of the lower quadrants, where the lower right is actually the hardware of the collective. Infrastructure is the hardware of the collective, and the social systems are the software of the collective. Those four, the hardware and software of the individual and the collective is one taxonomy that is necessary and sufficient for understanding human experience and human behavior. So there are things that condition human behavior in the upper right, physiologic predispositions for human behavior, predispositions for feeling more depressed, feeling happier, feeling, you know, having more empathy, less, et cetera. There are mimetic predispositions for behavior, religions, value systems, trauma, et cetera. There are economic and cultural predispositions for behavior, right? As long as that old growth redwood tree is worth $100,000 cut down as timber, but it's worth nothing alive on my balance sheet, then that economic, that extractionary, non-appreciable, recognizing economic system is going to lead to cutting all the damn trees down, which we've seen. And the same with the whale being worth $1 million on a fishing boat, but worth nothing alive in the ocean, right? Like the economics conditions human behavior. And infrastructure actually conditions human behavior, which is a interesting but important point. It ends up being not net neutral mimetically, right? If you have an infrastructure where the only way to get electricity is from coal, which we know is causing inexorable harm to other life, right? Mountaintop removal, mining, mercury in the ocean, whatever, but we need electricity to live. You cannot have full empathy in that infrastructural system. You actually have to downregulate your empathy to justify getting along. And even though you'll want to not look at certain pictures and videos when they come across because you know you're contributing to things you actually can't really handle contributing to. So you'll turn down your awareness, you'll change your behavior, you'll turn down empathy because infrastructure is actually predisposing patterns of mimetics and behavior, right? So all four of those quadrants are irreducible to each other, but interaffecting. So if we have solutions that are in any quadrant only, they will be inadequate. And what you try and do in any quadrant will necessarily affect and be affected by the other ones. So if we want to think about civilization, it's not civilization design because we're not talking about top-down architecture. It's the design of processes that lead to emergence, right? If we want to think about civilization, birth, midwifing, right? It is supporting the emergence of a viable, self-organizing, healthy, resilient civilization. We think about the foundational shifts that have to happen in each of those quadrants. And, you know, we mentioned most of them involve closing open loops so that our decision-making is omni-considerate. Our decision-making ends up being in the highest good of all that is being affected by the decision.
What are some of the more pressing loops that need closing right now, in your opinion, especially moving into 2017, what's happening in the world right now, what's happening in the States?
With the U.S. elections, 2017, one of the things that we see is a system, a political system that has been breaking and really broken for some time, having more complete and obvious breakage. And so we see a Democratic Party that has all of the kind of vested interests that it has co-evolved with and, you know, damage structures that it has, having supported one of the least well-liked candidates in recent history and anti-supported one of the most well-liked candidates in recent history, resulting, you know, in its failure. The Republican Party failed to have any really adequate candidates come forward. And so a candidate that represented change by being outside of the system won, even though it in so many ways represented regressive change. And so the two-party system as a whole broke. Each of the major platforms broke. And where a relatively small percentage of people in the United States used to know that there was real corruption involved in the political process, a much higher percentage of people know that now and have less faith that just going to the polls and voting is an adequate solution to the revolution that they might hope happens. So what that portends for future election cycles and also how people start to have civic engagement independent of elections is all interesting, right? You know, Trump is a very interesting person in this position with the cabinet that's coming because there's plenty of really concerning things, right? There's plenty of really concerning things in terms of the emboldening of bigotry that has already been here, you know, so deeply, but that in being brought to the light and the surface and emboldened in that way is both more concerning, more problematic, but also more capable of being healed because it's more obvious. Represents an existentially catastrophic view on the climate and energy, but is also starting to be surrounded by some people that have meaningfully better perspectives, like Elon Musk and others. So hopefully there is influence potential there. But we also see things like really seeking to remove people from office who have had crony capitalist ties for such a long time and propose things like auditing the Fed that are actually revolutionary in a good way. And so it's very interesting to see what could happen over the next time period here. But what we're seeing is, let's look at it from a larger sense, because similar things are happening in other places in the world, right? Not just in politics, but in the failure of several developed countries' economic systems and, you know, et cetera. If you think about it in terms of systems theory and complex adaptive systems, there's a kind of foundational principle that says complexity will evolve within any organizational system inexorably, just because there's movement, and with movement there are self-interacting dynamics, and that's going to lead to increased complexity, right? And so complexity is going to evolve within any organizational system until it actually exceeds that organizational system's capacity to manage. And when it exceeds it, you're going to start getting increased chaos and then increased entropy, and then the dissolution of that organizational system. And then you're either going to get the entropic step down to the previous level of organization, or out of the chaos, you get the emergence of a higher level of organization that isn't a retrofit of the previous system, but a fundamentally new kind of system. That's the place that globally, I would say, we're at. We have, you know, representative democracy is just fundamentally not capable of handling the kinds of collaborative decision making we need to make right now. When you think about the founding of the United States and the time when people would get together in a town hall without representative decision making, right? They'd get together and all vote on something, and then someone would have to be picked to represent the whole group who's going to ride a horse to where all the other town halls met to decide what the state did. Or it made sense to have representatives for very real technologic limits, you know, and there were other reasons that were argued, but that was a part of the ideology of the whole thing, right? And then when you couldn't have a town hall big enough for the whole population, and so we have an internet town hall big enough for the whole population, nobody has to ride a horse. We don't need the representatives in the same way. We have people that actually have real topic matter expertise that can be groups of decentralized peer-to-peer mavens that can actually make relevant decisions based on real knowledge of how those kinds of systems work, connected with the data and the facts, you know, necessary. We've already seen these kind of peer-to-peer systems do better decision-making at the scale of complexity they're operating than a representative democratic system would. So, you know, that system served evolutionary relevance, but it is obsolete. And if you think about it, could you have representative democracy where you have people in positions of legislative power where those people are still agents within capitalism who need to advantage themselves within capitalism as individuals and members of families? Could you have representative democracy and capitalism together and not have it become crony capitalism? Well, we have never seen it happen. And it's just a structural thing. It's not just particular bad people, right? It's just structural. You have a system where you incentivize people to acquire stuff, and then you put people in a position to legislate in the interest of things that they're more interested in. And, you know, that's going to happen, right? So capitalism and, you know, an economic system that externalizes as much harm to the commons as possible, right? And where your profit margin's actually proportional to how much harm you can externalize, that pits all different kinds of people against each other in ways that keep enmity unavoidable. You know, a linear materials economy that is devastating the biosphere that we live on across the entire thing. Like, so that whole system, it wasn't self-terminating when the complexity was low enough that we had a billion people and we cut trees down with axes. But with the kinds of industrial fishing boats that can just trawl the entire ocean, with slash and burn, with ICBM, you know, and 7 billion of us, that same kind of mindset we had becomes very quickly extinctionary. And so the scope of our power, the complexity of our problems, the number of us are making those systems fail. Now we can think of this as the baby at the end, right? The complexity of its being kept growing, which meant more and more cells, which meant a bigger baby, until it was at the end of how big it could fit in there and never get out of the birth canal, which triggered the contractions for it to come out, right? Now, sometimes the mom and baby die in the birth process. That can happen. But if it's supported properly, then rather than die in the birth process, you get discrete phase shift into the next phase of evolution. And that's exactly where I see us at over the next, you know, from an evolutionary time period, very small period of time, which is the ability to have the evolution and emergence of systems that support a globally interconnected human civilization that is actually on the asset side of nature's balance sheet rather than on the liability side.
So what kind of things can we do as a civilization to kind of aid in that midwifery process to allow for this baby to be born?
Any of the places where you can help close major open loops and then do it in ways that can lead to scalability are things worth looking at. So if you think about infrastructure, the ability to change production and waste management, manufacturing, to a closed loop process. So you start thinking about, could we have decentralized systems of 3D, 4D printing with modular upgradability built in rather than designed in obsolescence and proprietary nonsense built in, and cradle to cradle design built in, and then have them connected to recycling systems that move to lower entropy and higher efficiency, moving eventually towards things like atomic sorting, where then the old things get to be brought back into the individual parts to make new things, all run on renewable energy sources, low toxicity, low entropy, renewable energy sources. On the biologic side of that, the stem cell meat, the vertical farming, the synthetic biology as part of the, you know, creative materials process, and then the waste management of the organic fractions involves anaerobic digestion, algae scrubbers, et cetera. And so there is no waste. There is no raw material sourcing that isn't part of that closed loop. Building those systems, and not just individual technologies, but those, but the guilds, the ecosystems of those technologies that lead to closed loop sustainability of that system, and then scalability of those systems, that is stuff that is worth building. So if you look at building the future of our social systems, and knowing that the goal of our social systems has to be aligning the incentive of agents with the well-being of other agents in the commons, you start thinking about how to close the incentive well-being gap, how to close the externality gap, then building ways to measure externalities and just see them, to then be able to quantify them and internalize them, those are technologies worth building, right? To be able to build a balance sheet of the commons, the built world commons, the natural world commons, to be able to have data mine sources as well as repurpose the IoT sensor systems to have real-time sensor-driven balance sheet of the commons, right? So then we can see where the commons are net increasing in their resilience versus decreasing, where they're decreasing, what actions by what, you know, players are involved in that, and, you know, how to really quantify it. Those are things that should happen. Starting to move towards things like robotic automation of the shitty jobs that does allow the ability to have things like a commonwealth economics really start to emerge, and then looking at the accounting systems of how a commonwealth economics, access-based systems rather than possession-based systems. So when you start to think about people's access to Uber rather than owning a car, if you had an Uber system where there were enough cars in close proximity for peak time, that's the total amount of cars that have to be in the system,
that's still something like a 20th of the amount of cars that are in systems where people drive themselves and the cars spend 95% of their time sitting. That's a lot less resource taken out of the earth for actually more utility, value, safety, et cetera, in the transportation system, especially as those cars become self-driving and then all electric, upgradable, and then everyone can have access to the highest transportation possible rather than what you could afford previously. And your access to the resource doesn't limit my access to the resource, whereas your possession would limit my access. So in a situation where there's a finite amount of stuff and the less of it there is, the more value is added to it, but not real utility value, right? Like even though gold has some real utility value as a conductor, as a reflector, we don't use it for its utility value. We put it in bars and put it in a safe where nobody really uses it for anything at all other than representational value based on its scarcity. But we will damage ecosystems that are actually supporting our atmosphere and cleaning our water and making pollinators work to get to the gold, right? And because there's enough air that I don't have any differential value having some of it over someone else, there's no value. So we just keep ruining the shit out of it. So how to have a real valuation system that is valuing proportional to real value rather than, you know, nonsense value that's about differential advantage and competitive systems. So building those valuation systems, you know, those are the kinds of things that need to happen. Building the blockchain kinds of technologies, the post-Ethereum, you know, kinds of technologies that allow non-corruptible contracts and currency and metacurrency exchange and governance, right? So in the social systems, these are all things that need to happen to bring about the future of social system. In worldview, building better systems of education that actually help develop children's innate unique capacities and their intrinsic incentive to thrive and experience life fully and contribute to life fully. Helping to develop and evolve those education systems, and then helping to also develop media that gets to support people with real information. So the future of sense-making systems and news networks and, you know, educational resources where information that is trustworthy and relevant happens, right? Peer-to-peer vetting processes, et cetera, as well as the right kinds of psychotherapeutic processes for reconditioning people that have went through so much trauma and damage, and then being able to be in a position to raise future humans with less damage. Built world technologies that are designed to evolve and support the well-being of the humans in those systems while being sustainable with the planet, rather than being cognizant of only very few metrics they affect. So that means paint that isn't filled with VOCs that are carcinogens and neurotoxins and endocrine disruptors. It means paying attention to the kind of lighting that's involved in all the building materials, et cetera, for not just aesthetics and the utility of keeping rain off, but for recognizing that if humans are going to spend 90% of their time in built structures, how do you build those structures in a way that is conditioning optimum human experience and predisposition of the people who are in those? So that kind of intentional architecture and design process. So all of these are the kinds of things that internalize externalities, that do more comprehensive design for all that is affected, close the causal loops, and don't just support something being better within a self-terminating system, but support the infrastructure, the core structures of new systems emerging.
Okay, this is interesting. A lot of young people ask us for advice on what they can do to contribute to a more positive and sustainable future. It seems like from your framework, closing loops is the big answer, and they can close loops in any number of industries. But what would you add to that?
The fact of them asking you the question is something I would have them look at. If they are asking you what they can work on to have their life be of greatest value to life, it's a great care. And if they understand you as people who have studied things that are relevant to that, getting your input is valuable. To the degree, though, that they are seeing you as authorities and they're looking for an external authority to give them the answer to what to do with their life, that thinking itself is one of the things they have to overcome. And if you think about the way most people have been raised as children, we very rarely got punished for doing what the authorities wanted us to do. And most all of the times we got punished were for doing things that we wanted to do, that maybe appealed to our own sensibilities or desires, intuitions, feelings. And most of the time that we got praised and rewarded was for doing things that the authorities either wanted us to do or, you know, were at least aligned with what they figured, what we figured from previous expressions they'd probably want us to do. And so this is a very deep conditioning when we are most susceptible to conditioning to look to others, to look to teachers and Sunday school leaders and parents and, you know, authorities to tell us how to live our life. And when we touched our bodies, we found that the parts of our bodies that felt best to touch were the parts that we got most in trouble for touching. So obviously what feels good to us is bad. So we can't trust our feelings, but the authorities know that it's bad. So we can apparently trust the authorities, but not our feelings. And no one was ever really interested in our thoughts or perspectives. They were predefined right answers to things. And we got praised when we got them and we got in trouble when we didn't get them. And people were not generally interested in our aesthetic and design ideas. They were interested in us keeping clean things that were someone else's design ideas. And so we got conditioned very deeply in that system. That is part of the system that is self-terminating, because most people are working at jobs that are causing more net harm to the world than benefit, that they don't actually feel good about, but they do not trust their own feeling or believe that they can do something else or know how to actually figure out what to do or believe in themselves enough to self-assess or self-initiate. And most people, when they look at various situations in the world, actually feel really not okay with much of the way the world is in ways that come actually from love in them, that come from beauty in them, even if expressed as anger or jadedness. But they don't believe in their own ability to find solutions, to figure shit out. So they just numb out. They numb out on alcohol or on TV or whatever they do. And so when you look at the people that have ever meaningfully moved the world forward, where they solved some problems that had not been solved, that really needed to be solved, nobody taught them how to do it because no one could, because the problem wasn't solved yet. Nobody could have taught Edison how to make a light bulb. Nobody could have told Gandhi how to get home rule for India. And one of the fascinating things was that they decided to do it because they knew that it was important before having any idea how to do it. And then they trusted in both the rightness of it enough and their own capability to learn enough to really apply themselves deeply and to continue through all of the early not successes until they found stuff. So what I would encourage young people to do is to take profound responsibility for their existence and to know that there are a lot of people and a lot of books and a lot of courses that have valuable shit to teach them. But if an adequate answer to what they should do with their life existed anywhere, that whole thing would be done already. And the fact that the things aren't done means that all the best teachers and thinkers have not got it yet, right? They have ideas. They have things to learn. You should absolutely learn from them. And you're going to have something to add, not only in terms of your work, but also in terms of your creativity. So I would say, look around at the world and see all of the things that really bother you. And realize that them bothering you is part of your guidance. And see all the things that you really love, all the things that are beautiful. And you realize they're connected, right? Animals are beautiful, and then all of the devastation of animals and their habitat is really bothersome. People are beautiful, so homelessness and war are bothersome, right? Children are beautiful, so bad education systems are bothersome. So look at what you love. Look at how what you love is not well supported in various areas, and realize that it does not have to be that way any more than the world had to stay dark in the time of Edison. And yet for all of human history before Edison, it did, right? And taking on something that seemed impossible literally delivered the world from darkness in that way, right? And then study the shit out of the topic, right? Without thinking that a completely adequate solution is there, that there's probably a lot of partially good solutions, maybe a technology that is totally good technology, but it hasn't, market feasibility hasn't came about yet, or the way to bring the meme out there, or parts of the ideas are there, but they need synthesized, or whatever it is. Study the problem well. Study what an adequate solution would look like. Gain a real clear insight of what adequate solution looks like in your own area of what you care to contribute to. And as things emerge that you feel like you can contribute to, as you're learning about it, contribute to them. And continue to assess on your own and initiate on your own with, of course, good input from all the places of good input. That's the key thing, I would say. take really deep responsibility for the impact that you have in your life while you're here. And then all of the study, all the training, all the application that you need to empower the kind of impact you want to have, make sure that happens.
Excellent
advice. That's great, yeah.
Daniel, thank you for joining us. This has been enlightening.
Yeah, the thought that you've done on all of these things is fascinating.
It's a delight to be here with you. And when I see two intelligent, creative people who are looking at the world and saying, what is a vision of a beautiful world that is commensurate to our full capability and potential, and that is realistic and grounded in the face of our real capability and potential, and asking what you can do to help bring about the positive versions of the future, helping to even get positive visions of the future from people who have thought about it well and share those with people is an incredible work. And I'm delighted to see this podcast and what you're doing, and delighted to be here with you on it.
Thanks. We're looking forward to chatting with you again.
All right. That's it for this episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. If you want the show notes, they will be at futurethinkers.org/36. This episode is brought to you by Eternity, the Oracle machine. Eternity is a new blockchain platform for smart contracts with a token crowd sale launching in March 2017. Go to futurethinkers.org/eternity and subscribe to their mailing list to get notified when it goes live.
To get notified of new podcasts and videos, go to futurethinkers.org and subscribe to our mailing list. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, give us a like or a review, share it with your friends, and consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/futurethinkers. If you're looking to get serious about meditation, check out the meditation app that we've created with Vinay Gupta called The Cutting Machinery. Go to cuttingmachinery.org/app.